without Hans Dietze, there would be no tasting. I would probably be listening to an iPod, a little iPod speaker. This is the man who has mentored me through where we're at now, and he has brought something that I have wanted to hear myself here for 4 years. The absolutely legendary, wonderful RCA LC1 series speakers. So, Hans?
Okay, with that introduction, after World War II, the FCC changed the standards. FM broadcasting finally became a reality despite all those fights between Armstrong and Sarnoff. And the specifications, if I recall correctly, for 30 cycles to 15,000 cycles. Everything in the chain was supposed to be able to do that. So RCA embarked on a program of improving the ribbon microphones and having a new monitor loudspeaker. Harry Olsen and his crew at Princeton came up with what everyone knows as the Duocone, and I'll pass a couple of pictures around. The pictures are of the latest incarnation. The latest incarnation is in this cabinet, he said, making sure. And the very first one, which came, I guess it was put into production in 1948, was called MI-11411. You could not buy the loudspeaker from RCA as a frame loudspeaker. You had to buy the cabinet, the speaker, and a BA4 monitor amplifier built into the cabinet, and a special high-frequency attenuator network, which had a switch protruding through the side of the cabinet. You've all seen those. I think people call them Art Deco cabinets. There are still a few around. As time went on, various improvements came. The first improvement had to do with changing the dispersion to make it even better. The idea was that this was a 120-degree loudspeaker. And as the picture that's passing through will show you, that was achieved by putting paper elliptical domes in an asymmetrical configuration glued to the low frequency cone, which provided more stiffness as well as dispersion, and having a little aluminum deflector vane, colloquially called the butterfly, which had precise angles and a jig to make it all turn out right, to reflect the high frequency sound from the butterfly and then off those vanes so that it really was fully 120 degrees all the way out to 15,000 cycles. Other improvements over time, that was the LC1A, and it looked like this picture except it was a different color and it had a paper surround all the way out to the end. Then there was an LC1B, which had a cloth surround to make the self-resonant frequency a little lower. In all other respects, it was the same, except that some economizing marketeer decided that the external attenuator should no longer be an option, and so the frame, which had a three-terminal board so that the high-frequency unit could be connected to the attenuator, had the hole for the terminal strip deleted, and the high frequency unit was simply connected to its internal crossover network. There was no way to do an external network unless you went in and snipped some wires and, you know, did it yourself. Then came the day that some marketing guy said to me, "We sold 50 LC1s to this huge hall down south somewhere, and they're going to put 50 of them in the ceiling for sound reinforcement." And I said, "You said what?" I said, "You know, the broadcast people and the recording studio people are constantly forgetting to pull their gates away from the heads. They're constantly burning out high frequency units. And it's only a little paper voice coil, and it's like number 43 aluminum wire. And you're putting them in a ceiling 30 feet away for sound reinforcement. Can't you sell them something else?" And they said, "No, we signed the contract." I said, "Well." So I gave it some thought, and I had one of those little moments of insight that occasionally comes to us. I thought, what is the very worst thing that could happen if you visualize a voice coil and nothing burned up? Well, the worst thing that could happen is eventually the wire would melt, but it would still conduct. So the idea was, how could I redesign the high frequency unit so that it would tolerate more heat? Well, I had a friend who was working in the DuPont Experimental Station in Wilmington. And he said, we've just invented this marvelous new film called Kapton. I said, tell me more about it. He said, well, it's a very high temperature material. I said, oh, send me a sample roll. So they sent me this sample roll of Kapton. And I went over to the chemical people in the military section who were at the time fixing radios for Vietnam. And I said, I want the very highest temperature epoxy you know how to make. What do you want it for? I want to insulate wires. But there's no such thing for insulation. Eventually it turned out that if I used the word encapsulant, that had a whole different meaning to them. Oh, you want to encapsulate something. Yeah, we do that all the time to fix military stuff. I said, I want the very highest temperature thing you can make. I came back 2 weeks later, and he handed me four separate tubs of material and said, you mix A with B, and you coat it, and you put it in the oven, and then when it comes out, then you mix B and C and do this as a four-part epoxy. I said, surely you jest. I have to wind this wet. I have to run the... So then I said, I'm in over my head. I don't know how to design a coil winder that can wind wet epoxy onto fragile aluminum wire. But fortunately, the friend of plant engineering's, this guy was a friend of the manager of plant engineering who had been a military engineer, and I walked over to him and said, here's my problem. I need to design a coil winder, but I don't know how. And I suspect because of the nature of the materials that the bobbin, the winding bobbins, are going to have to be made out of Teflon, which is very soft. And I laid out the whole program for him. He said, well, I just happen to have an engineer who thrives on problems like that, and he's just come off a task, and he's yours. So together, we designed a modified winding machine that used hardened Teflon. It turned out that this engineer had a trick that nobody else knew how to do. He knew how to surface harden Teflon. So we machined the bobbins, and he surface hardened the Teflon, and we had the pot of this strange mixture of four chemicals. It turned out we mixed all four and wet wound them and then pre-baked them and then took them out and tested and then baked them the rest of the way. It was an excruciatingly difficult process, and it was very expensive. And I hope this tape doesn't go anywhere, but there's no more RCA anyway. I wanted to sell them, of course. I didn't want just a curiosity for my laboratory. I wanted something that people could buy. And I knew that this was going to be ridiculously expensive. But the factory building that housed my LC1 production line happened to be in a defense products plant. And with a little creative bookkeeping, somehow the price to the commercial division for this work turned out to be reasonable. Thank you all for subsidizing. And so we made them. And it wasn't easy. The yield, when we finally got going, the yield was 50%. We had to throw half of them away because the tolerances were very tight. Then, of course, one has to solder these wires. Well, aluminum is very hard to solder to, so I had them. And I can't remember if I'd been prepared, I'd looked it up. I had some samples that were silver-plated aluminum, but I think for production it was copper-plated aluminum, just enough so we could solder to it. But the folks doing the soldering said the epoxy from winding the coil goes down to the ends of the wire, and we can't get it off. So I went back to the chemist, and I said, you know, before I was asking you for armor-piercing shells, now I need the armor. And he said, I don't think so. Well, eventually we wound up with a bath of something called Yukon oil that was kept at a precisely controlled temperature, and we put some really nasty, OSHA would never approve it today, stripper in glass test tubes, and we dangled the leads into the glass test tubes and cooked it for certain lengths of time and then wiped them off dry and then with alcohol, and the ones that didn't break off were ready to be soldered. And we put the speaker together, and lo and behold, it did everything I wanted it to do. It sounded just as good. It drew the same curve. It could be sold interchangeably with any other one we had ever made, which is one of the things we really took pride in doing. And it was a lot stronger. And I gave a talk at the AES in 1969 on it. And to make a point, I brought a pair of vacuum tube 250-watt amplifiers, and I turned it up until the fuses blew. And what I did is I picked a 1-amp instrument fuse that was a very fast-blowing fuse. And the way I said it to the engineers was, if you provide a signal that is not clipped, in other words, if you have an amplifier so large that the wave shape is always going to be nicely sinusoidal, you cannot burn out this high frequency unit. The fuse, I guarantee you, the fuse will always burn out before the speaker will. Well, in a real world, of course, they find ways anyway. But they lasted a lot better, and it made a practical unit out of it. And to my great surprise, Harry Olson wrote me a very nice letter, which I have at home, thanking me for, once again, making his speaker the finest in the world. I'll treasure that always. So what we have here for you to listen to is a floor cabinet, which is called an LS-11. It came in two versions, walnut and plain Jane. This is the plain Jane. The walnut one was made of walnut veneered plywood, and oddly enough, the plain Jane one, which is flake board, is a little denser and a little stiffer, and is therefore just a teensy bit better acoustically. This cabinet has an LC-1C, identical to the picture. The picture you're seeing is this exact speaker, which is my engineering model. And the speaker on the right-hand side, your left, is an original 1948 11-411 from one of those cabinets. No domes, no tweeter, no epoxy, paper voice coil, but still a very nice sounding speaker. So, listen and enjoy.
Thank you.